Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You are listening to the Rethinking Faith podcast. I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and I'm glad that you're here. I'm a former pastor turned brewer with a deep love of theology and philosophy. Although I don't always wear the label comfortably, Christianity seems to be baked into who I am. I've found a home within the world of process relational thinking and have made close friends with the mystics. So whether you're a devout believer, a questioning skeptic, a bold atheist, or simply someone trying to figure out what it means to be human, you belong here. Thank you for joining me and taking the risk of entering into this sacred space. And thank you for reminding me that we aren't alone on this journey. Let us imagine a better way to be human together. Shall we begin? All right, friends, welcome back to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson, and joining me today for the very first time is James McGrath. James, how's it going?
It's going well. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on the show. You survived living in a house with me for a couple days at Theology Beer Camp and saw the less publicly presentable versions of Josh, you know, after maybe having a few spirits, and you still chose to come hang out on the podcast, so I appreciate
it. I thought you were gonna say you know, sort of early morning Josh was the
scary one. That's good to know.
Neither was scary. I'm in fact, if anything, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, given that we were actually sharing accommodations, you know, it was a large house with people scattered all throughout it, including the basement. And I'm sorry we didn't actually get to hang out and chat more than we did.
Yeah. But I'm glad now we get to make up for that.
Yeah. So, cool. I love this technology. It means, you know, it's like, yeah, we were in the same house. We didn't get to talk, but we can, you know, we can get on Zoom.
Yeah. So, James, I want to know, well, actually, first, let's do this. How about, if you wouldn't mind, would you introduce yourself a little bit for listeners who might not be familiar with you or your work? Let's start there.
Yeah. So my name is James McGrath. I am a religious studies professor, mostly working on things to do with New Testament early Christianity. That's what I started out in. That's what I got my PhD in. But I teach at Butler University. And so I also teach in our core curriculum, a wide array of courses. I teach upper level courses on subjects not related to the Bible, or at least not directly, like religion and science fiction. And so have branched out, have a lot of interests, and yeah, very short attention span. And so keep moving on to new research topics and things like that. But I'm very passionate about informing general audiences about the kinds of stuff that we do and trying to get the stuff that's important, right? And not everything that scholars talk about is important or interesting, but some of it is, right? Especially if you're interested in the Bible or interested in theology, interested in big questions, and love just trying to figure out how to communicate that to a general audience.
Yeah. So how, what's your kind of like background and upbringing then? Like, how did you kind of fall into kind of like New Testament Bible type studies and such?
Yeah. So how long have we got for this show? I'll try to do
as long as you want.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. Good thing we made an early start, right? So I grew up in the Catholic Church. My mother had a mixture of Catholic and Jewish ancestry. My father, as you might guess from the name, was Irish Catholic on all sides of that lineage going back. But I sort of wandered away, went into a sort of a seeker phase in my teens, and in the context of a Pentecostal church, a friend's church, had a born-again experience, right? So I had a religious experience, and that got me into the context of what, broadly speaking, one would call evangelicalism. Pentecostal is very, but often there's a lot more emphasis on experience than on like doctrine and dogma. And so probably if I had grown up in a different sort of church context, if it had been, let's say, Baptist or Presbyterian or something like that, of a sort of fundamentalist bent, then I might have found it much more difficult to rethink a lot of things. But that experience made me want to do something related to that. And so this was during high school. And so after high school, I went to Bible college thinking, you know, am I going to be a pastor, missionary? I don't know. And met someone who was very persuasive and said they thought I'd be good at teaching. I also apparently was persuasive because she married me, but ended up going into education and ended up teaching. My wife is from Romania, and so I actually went there and taught for a few years. There was a very urgent short-term need for people to help get things started there. Sort of after the fall of communism, you know, they're trying to get religious education up and going. But once you start studying the Bible, even if you are motivated because of experiences or teaching or upbringing or anything like that in a conservative religious context, actually looking that closely at the Bible will challenge a lot of the assumptions and the things you've heard. And I consider myself to have been fortunate that I didn't grow up steeped in that, and that I had this experience that was fairly important to me, because it meant that if something didn't seem to line up with what I was hearing, but the Bible seemed to be the evidence of the Bible seemed to be pointing in that direction, I felt free to follow it in a way that I know sometimes can seem like a hurdle, can seem almost like it's at odds with your faith instead of an expression of your faith. But yeah, to make a long story short, that got me started, and I'm still doing it.
Awesome. Well, thanks. Thanks for sharing a bit about that. I think story is really powerful, and so I always think it's fun to kind of hear people's story and a little bit of behind the thing that they're doing. We're going to talk about your new book, but I have one more question I want to ask you that perhaps is not a fair question. So I know that you are, as you mentioned, you do some like science fiction type stuff, mm-hmm. and at Beer Camp, you had a cool different they're calling like geek stage type stuff, like cool science fiction, like Star Wars, Star Trek type shirt on like every day. And so I know you love that world, but if you had to pick one, I don't know, fandom perhaps is the word for it, that you find like the most transcendence in, like which one are you going to go with?
Oh gosh. Yeah. And I don't know if people can see what's on my, on my shelves here, which might seem that I'm leaning more in one direction than the other. So I better bring up most of my toys and geekery that's here are things that people have given me. So somebody who knew that I was like a fan actually sent me, I think their wife had persuaded them that they needed to get rid of this Star Trek model. But I also have Darth Tater, and I have like Star Trek action figures. I should have had all those up there if I'd known this question was coming. But yeah, I like a lot of them. And you know, rather than get into the debates between Star Trek and Star Wars, things like that, I'll mention one that I really enjoyed rewatching with my son, writing about recently, that I know people have mixed feelings about, some very strong positive, some negative, some loved it except for the last season. But why don't I mention Lost? That's one that doesn't get as much appreciation, I think. Of course, there's no real action figures or things. They never really did that. Those would be cool. Somebody should do that, right? Now that you have 3D printers, maybe someone will hear this. If they want to send them to me, I will display them proudly on my shelf. But Lost, I thought, did a good job of exploring the intersection between seeking answers in the realm of science, seeking answers in the realm of faith, the possibility that they might be different perspectives on the same mysterious aspects of reality. And for people like me who like mysteries and like trying to figure out, well, okay, so what are they doing on this show, right? What's this actually about? What's going on here? It really did lead us down that rabbit hole, only to ultimately challenge us and say, if you are in an afterlife and reconnect with all these people, and you're not going to be like, okay, finally, what was the smoke monster, right? It's going to be, wow, I am so glad to see these people, and these connections, live on and transcend, our human existence as we have known it in our sort of mortal lives. And, it really challenged that whole approach of to faith, I think, of, it being all about getting the answers, right? Some of the characters were willing to go really far, and cross some really, some pretty clear ethical lines, in the interest of pursuing those answers. There were some people who seemed to have an inside track and to know stuff, and we were willing to trust them the way people sometimes trust, religious leaders, even though some of these people show themselves to be not really trustworthy and to not really know as much as they tried to give the impression they did in the interest of bolstering their authority. And so it really got at a lot of interesting aspects of religion, I thought, when you paid close attention to those themes.
Yeah, so I'll be honest, I have not watched Lost, and you just kind of sold me on it, so maybe now I have to go do it. Yeah, that was pretty persuasive. So I
And I'll tell you, it
took
was
note.
tough, like having to wait a week, having to wait a week, and then having to wait until the next season and stuff like that. And so now you can just like get it all. And but it is one where, if it hooks you, then yeah, you're gonna not want to go back to work and leave the next episode until the next day or something. So.
Well, good deal. Thank you for the recommendation. I'll have to check back in with you and let you know
Oh yeah.
how
Get me
it
back
goes.
on when you after you've seen it.
There we go. The conversation on Lost. Well, today specifically, I thought it'd be fun to focus on your new book, the A to Z, the A to Z of the New Testament, Things Experts Know That Everyone Else Should Too. I was excited about this because I have a bit of a theory, and I want to run it by you and see what you think. In my non, like, I don't have a PhD, I'm not in the academy, but I read more than your average person. I'm a little bit of a nerd. In my, whatever you want to call that experience, it seems to me that there is a disconnect. Not only between pastors and their congregation, as far as what they think the Bible is and how it works, this kind of thing, and also depending on the denominations, because this isn't true for everybody, a disconnect between pastors and the academy, even. And so I was excited about your book because I think it helps address that. So I'm curious, do you see that kind of like disconnect, whatever at all?
Yes. And that was a strong motivation for actually writing the book. So on the one hand, I think there are some pastors who, almost all pastors should have studied this stuff, right? Usually in a seminary, even if you go to a conservative seminary, you'll hear about a lot of, scholarly perspectives. You may be told to view them negatively and to reject them, but you will hear about them normally, at some point, right? They get mentioned in commentaries, even conservative commentaries will often be interacting with mainstream views. But often you'll hear that, and you'll hear from pastors, if somebody comes in as a guest and actually says some of this stuff, like works it into a sermon, and a lot of it isn't good sermon material, like the synoptic problem and how you relate the gospels. It's relevant to how you interpret the gospels, but it's not a sermon subject in its own. And so there's a good reason why a lot of free pastors don't give a lot of this information. But some think, oh, if you show how all these difficulties and these different points of view, people lose their faith. And it's this self-fulfilling prophecy, because that's only true if you've told them that the Bible is simple and you've given them this oversimplified package. And then, sure, if you've sold them on that and led them to believe that's what faith is, and that questioning and asking and investigating and learning and changing your mind are all incompatible with faith, then of course they're going to have a traumatic experience. But you've set them up for that, right? And there's a whole approach to preaching that actually, I think, causes people to lose their faith when they encounter this stuff, because they've been told that the Bible is something that it's not. I think, though, even in contexts in which there's a much more friendly view of what scholars do, it still often is stuff that doesn't preach well, right? And so you think, well, you know, they'll get that in Sunday school. That's not for a sermon. But of course, the Sunday school teachers are even less likely than the pastor to have studied these things, and so may not have that background. And so there's definitely a disconnect. And sometimes it's for principled, but I think wrong and misguided reasons. And other times it's just because nobody's there delivering the kind of content that, you know, even in a, you know, Sunday school format where it's not going to be like a heavy duty academic research session or something like that, but it's going to talk about some of these things in a bit more detail than, you know, would fit a sermon.
Yeah, that I mean, that's definitely been my experience. I think so I kind of grew up in like the more kind of evangelical type tradition, started in like a Methodist church, and then my parents discovered that the Southern Baptist church down the road had fancy contemporary Christian music. Whoa. And so we stopped, you know, and ended up going to the Baptist church. And yeah, I think to your point, I have found that within that tradition, because of the way the Bible is talked about as like the ultimate authority, as inerrant, you know, etc., when somebody comes into like runs into biblical scholarship, even if it's not something that's controversial, right? It's not somebody trying to tear down the faith. It's not somebody, you know, whatever. It could just be a good Bible scholar. It undermines an entire faith system, and then, unfortunately, those people have been sold like the idea that this is Christianity, our one small minority, you know, tradition is the whole thing. And so, you know, people, I don't know, not to pick on people, because like, I don't know, you like find a Bart Ehrman book and then you're like, well, all of Christianity is bullshit. And it's like, well, Bart Ehrman's just like doing, he's a Bible scholar. You know, maybe not all scholars agree with his conclusions, but like, he's doing stuff in the academy. You know what I mean? So I think your book is much welcomed because of that. Because there is that kind of particular like weird thing where people are, I think, unnecessarily having their faith problematized just because of the tradition that they grew up in. If that makes sense. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And you'll sometimes hear, you know, the false dichotomy, like either it's the inerrant word of God, or you can just throw it out. It's not worth anything, right? And you know, nobody thinks that way in practice about the rest of life, right? It's like your parents were either inerrant or nothing they said was worth listening to. No, it's like, you know, it's like, and so if all we have in here are, you know, highly stylized and dramatized and symbolic and so on and so forth, accounts of people having some kind of genuine life-changing experience of the transcendent, that's worth paying attention to, right? They don't need to be inerrant. The things that they wrote don't need to be inerrant. Peter and Paul could have gotten into arguments, and we get to hear both sides maybe in the New Testament, and you know, that's perhaps okay. Maybe that's actually supposed to tell us that having this encounter with God doesn't mean we have all the answers, doesn't mean we don't have to try and figure stuff out and take the responsibility to do so, right? And so when you actually pay close attention to what these texts actually say, it's basically inviting us into a more robust and rich faith. And so these things don't need to be threatening, and in fact can enhance your faith, unless you've been indoctrinated that it's either, you know, absolute truth, and basically I know the truth 100%, and therefore I'm right, you know, and it bolsters one ego, and it's all basically idolatry, you know. And moving away from that, I mean, is really spiritually beneficial, Right. Even though a lot of people have been told it's a threat to their faith, it's actually something that might actually give them a chance to experience a much deeper and more real kind of faith for the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know, again, just experientially for me, one of my friends that has really helped, really helped me with my understanding of the Bible and stuff, is a guy named Jace. He's been on this podcast before. He's a like PhD Old Testament scholar, like went to Westminster, studied, with like Pete Enns, this kind of thing. The type. And he's kind of, been somebody who, when I first started asking questions, right out of college, he kind of helped walk me through some of these things and introduce them without it being as scary, and gave me room to ask the kind of questions and be like, Josh, you're not as smart as you think you are. Like, other people have asked these questions too. Like, you're not the first person to realize that, like, the birth narratives don't line up, or Jesus doesn't die on the same day in the Bible. Like, it's all good. Now, mostly he's an Old Testament scholar, so I used to give him a hard time and be like, Jace, you do know that there's like this whole other part where like there's a guy called Jesus and like some other cool stuff happens, but
And I can understand the appeal, the Old Testament. I mean, I was trying to basically do for the New Testament what Pete Enns does for the, Old Testament. And was honored that Pete actually endorsed the book, and so I was like, okay, that means maybe I managed to accomplish what I was aiming for here. But yeah, I mean, I think I was also very fortunate that I studied, I went and did some volunteer, youth ministry, children's camps and stuff in the summer after I finished high school, and ended up in the UK for my studies. And that I think helped too, because the evangelicalism there is not as compartmentalized away from everything else as some American evangelicalism is, at least conservative evangelicalism. And so, I was exposed to evangelical scholarship that was like, yeah, here are things actually within the Pentateuch that indicate that Moses is not the author of this, right? This stuff is from a later time. And between how I'd gotten to be interested in this in the first place and having people who are part of that same faith tradition and recommended reading helping me work through it, I was like, well, then why is anybody making an issue about this, right? Why is anybody emphasizing Moses wrote it when we have these things within the Bible, right? And that's something I've been trying to emphasize more and more, because I think it actually helps people realize the paradox of what you're often doing if you're an inerrantist. You end up defending your doctrine about the Bible from the evidence in the Bible. And when you're doing that, then the Bible is no longer your ultimate authority. Your doctrine about the Bible is allowed to tell the Bible what it is or is not allowed to say. And hopefully, I think a lot of people, if it's presented to them in that way, can understand that this is self-defeating, right? It's paradoxical, it doesn't make any sense. And why don't I actually see what the Bible says? And if it doesn't fit my constraints, why don't I let it burst my constraints and open up a wider realm of what Christianity can be, what faith can be.
Yeah, it's like I always found that interesting, because it was like, kind of toted that the people who have a high view of scripture are the ones that hold to like inerrancy and this kind of thing. And, the people who don't, like, you're just like liberals, whatever, trying to do a thing. When in my, like, in my perspective, how my brain works, it tells me, oh, well, if I meet the Bible where the Bible is and let the Bible be what the Bible wants to be, instead of, putting this doctrine on it, like you said, to me, that seems like a higher view of scripture, because you're reading it the way that it was intended to be read. But I don't know. That was just, I thought that was interesting.
There's a lot of lip service paid to the Bible, and I get students, teaching in the context that I do, teaching for the number of years that I've been teaching, had the chance to see just how often people come in and they're sure they're supposed to say nice things about the Bible, but they don't actually know what's in it, and so it's clear, when you're praising something as inerrant and you don't know anything but like the greatest hits. You're not actually a fan of the band if all you know are the greatest hits. And so people are saying stuff about the Bible, a Bible that they haven't read, that they regularly don't understand. And That's why I think the scholarship, you know, it actually helps you understand these texts. And that's what I think is crucial, right? And I've found that a lot of people who, if you say, well, German scholars in the 19th century said, they'll be like, oh, you know, keep it away from me. I'm warned against this stuff. Whereas if you say, okay, here is what looks like it could be the same story in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're similar, yet they're different. Break into small groups and see if you can figure this out and report back to me. And when the Bible itself is raising the questions, then when you come in and say, so here are what some scholarly perspectives are, some tools that might help try and make sense of this. And you know, some of the resistance that might otherwise be there, if it's presented in a different way, I think is overcome by doing it that way, letting the Bible raise the questions itself.
Yeah, I like that. That's a helpful, like, I get like pedagogical tool to do it that way. It kind of reminds me too of like the, I don't know, like the idea of like harm reduction when you're, I don't know, talking about like policy or something, right? If you're trying to you know, pass something like gun laws or gun control, then you don't get like some, you know, pop star to do that. You get like a military general to kind of introduce that. And so maybe the analogy is not quite working, but like it's the same thing. If you know, if you're introducing people and just like putting it in front of them and saying, look, like here's the Bible, let's read it and see what happens, versus like the Bible is blah blah blah, you know, that kind of scare tactic is taken away, and it like kind of it's the harm reduction. It lets people experience it for themselves. I like that. Noted. You know, these are the kind of things I wish I knew when I was, you know, an arrogant little youth pastor teaching high school kids. You
They're
know,
the things I wish I knew when I started doing what I'm doing, but
that.
you know, I figured out a few of them along the way, you know.
Well, James, so when it comes to the, you know, reading the Bible, so your book is really cool because it does, it has like some of the like larger concepts, and then also some of the chapters zoom in and get like really specific about, you know, particular stories or something like that. And one that might seem maybe silly to ask about, or somebody might be like, oh, well, I don't know, that's obvious. I think is actually the idea of interpreting the text, which you talk about, because at least in the space that I grew up in, there was kind of this idea, you know, that the perspicuity of scripture, it's simple. Anybody can read it and understand it, which like I don't even know that I disagree with that, but I don't think that you can just come to the Bible and read it at face value and not bring in your perspective and your thrownness in the world. So where, you know, how does that kind of play into our understanding of interpretation?
Yeah, thanks. And you know, in the book, I think it's inevitable that there will be some things in there that if you have a background and you spend a fair amount of time reading New Testament scholars, you'll pick up on a few things. I heard from people who, you know, had been to seminary, who had, you know, encountered biblical studies before, that they still learn things in there, which I hope so. But you know, I got a negative review on Amazon. It was like somebody was like, yeah, you don't need to point out that Revelations is wrong, that it's actually Revelation. And I'm like, oh yes, you do, right? I mean, you don't need to point out to some people, but some people need to hear it, right? And the fact that the book is not all stuff that's just aimed at you as the intended audience, I think, yeah, you know, I hope people in general will make room for that. But not every Amazon reviewer apparently feels the same way. But yeah, it's a good question about interpretation, and it really is central to, you know, what New Testament scholars do, and you know, then what theologians try to do at the intersection between, you know, their Christian heritage that includes the Bible and, you know, various other sources from down the ages, and our contemporary world, and, you know, questions related to how we understand things today. But yeah, it's, you'll often hear, you know, like people try and come use them as gotcha phrases in debates. It's like, oh, I don't interpret the Bible, I just read it. It's like, reading any text involves interpretation, right? Is the Song of Songs erotic poetry? Is it an allegory of, you know, Jesus and the church? Either way, you have made a decision, because people haven't understood it both ways, right? And there are plenty of stories, plenty of passages where people have understood the same words in the same way. People who have the same doctrine about the Bible, right, and view it as inerrant, say, this text, this inerrant text here, whose words I believe are clear and could be understood by anybody, mean, and then they say these two different things, right? And that in itself, I think, makes clear that there's interpretation happening, because interpretation is not this add-on to reading, right? It's reading and trying to understand and make sense of something. And especially if you're reading something that's in translation, you're reading something that was written in the context of another culture, then if it seems clear, and I deal with this in some parts of the book as well, if it seems clear, that's when you really should worry. So maybe there's something about the culture that's important, that, you know, maybe I'm reading this as an American and I'm assuming this, that, and the other. And maybe actually I need some background knowledge that I don't know I need in order to understand this the way the author and the earliest readers would have understood it. So yeah, interpretation is there throughout. And that just means we're reading, and some understanding of what we're reading is reaching our minds. That's all that interpretation means. Sometimes it involves, you know, getting a bit of background information or asking, you know, okay, so what does this word actually mean? What are its possible nuances? You know, what did this author mean by that? But even when you're not doing that, interpretation is still involved, because that's what reading involves. You know, you read a novel, you read a newspaper, you read a sacred text. The process of understanding it is interpretation.
Yeah, it's like, I always like to try to think of it as like, I can't not bring Josh to the table when I sit down and read. Like, and so for me, I've tried to become just more aware of my biases and just recognize that I definitely have them, right? Because I tend to lean more progressive politically. And so when I read Jesus, I'm like, Jesus agrees with me. Yeah. But then I have friends that lean more conservative politically, and they read the words of Jesus and they're like, no, Jesus agrees with me. You're wrong. And so I think being aware of those biases and blinders is important. You know, as you talked about, when we come to the text and just being honest about where we have them, because if we're cognizant of that, then that can kind of like help us be like, wait a minute, let's see what's actually going on here.
And that's something, you know, having turned my attention, you know, in recent years to the historical figure of Jesus, and most recently to John the Baptist.
Yeah,
I've been thinking a lot about this. So I'm going to have a couple of books coming out about John the Baptist this year, and it does seem to me that he placed a very strong emphasis on, you know, social and economic justice, and you know, was asking a question, okay, so am I basically, you know, am I reading John through my lens, or is my lens shaped by this tradition that John started, and that's why it's, you know, they're sort of converging in this way? But it's crucial to ask those questions, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that the John the Baptist stuff is interesting. I heard you talk, hinting at that a bit, or providing a lure, you know, if we want to use nice processy language, on Tripp's podcast, Homebred Christianity. So that's deeply interesting. I have a bunch of notes written down here, and like I told you, I was in jury duty all day, which means I was stuck in my own brain for 8 hours, and I'm super ADHD if you haven't picked up. So I'm jumping all over the place trying to see where I want to go. Let's jump into this, because I know that this was one for me that I initially struggled with when I first encountered it. It sure seems like in the New Testament, there are some failed prophecies, and maybe even that authors are doing weird stuff where they're going and like taking verses out of context to like make them try to mean something in like a prophetic sense. I don't know. Are we allowed to do that? So what's up with that, James?
And I tackle that head on. There's really sort of two problems there. And so I may, you know, if some of the people watching this only know one of them, then I may be introducing them to more problems. And so, if so, sorry, but hopefully also help you work through them. And so in terms of the second thing you mentioned, you know, where it's like, you know, look, this is fulfillment of prophecy, and then you look it up and it's like, this doesn't mean what I would have assumed when I read it quoted in the New Testament. I tackle that pretty directly. Asked, Would the author of the Gospel of Matthew have gotten an F in biblical interpretation if he took a course in it today? Because, it seems like he's doing that old switcheroo thing, taking texts out of context, giving the impression they mean something they don't. And interestingly enough, I don't think that's what's going on there. I think it's appropriate to be open to that possibility that, maybe he's doing something that we don't entirely think is okay. We should at least explore that possibility. We shouldn't shut it down immediately. But I think, if he had been playing fast and loose with these texts, I think, he wouldn't have gotten away with it, right? Because people knew these texts, right? I think the issue is that Christians reading the Gospel of Matthew don't know where some of these quotes are from. They've never looked them up. They certainly don't have those texts memorized. They haven't heard them read in the synagogue, the whole of their life. And so they assume that what Matthew is saying when he says Jesus fulfills this, this scripture is fulfilled, stuff like that, that he means these people were predicting Jesus and predicting the details of his life. And I have encountered people who said, the reason I became a Christian is because there are all these prophecies predicting Jesus. And I'm like, okay, at some
point
later,
you're gonna want to skip this chapter in my book.
Yeah, but at some point later, we might want to talk. But I certainly don't want to pull that out from under them, like right away. It's like if they're just getting started, but they might encounter some difficulties later on, and this could get awkward. But we look at those texts in their original context, and we see that there are patterns, right? So Matthew keeps quoting these texts that are about the story of Israel, and so I think what he's saying is that he's viewing the story of Jesus through the lens of these other stories, and he's revisiting those stories through the lens of Jesus. And he's seeing this typology at work where Jesus's, the details of Jesus's life can be understood as mirroring, as echoing, as connected with that greater story. And he sees Jesus' significance as the long-awaited Messiah, one who doesn't quite match up to the expectations in many respects. As nonetheless connecting in important ways with that story, right? And so it's part of how these early Christians were making sense of it. Now, when you said about, prophecy not being fulfilled, I thought you were going to be asking about, sort of things like there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God come with power, or in Matthew's version, it's even worse, until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, which seems even more clearly to me, not just, the arrival of the kingdom of God, maybe the gift of the Holy Spirit, day of Pentecost. We can work with this somehow. But the second coming, right? The end of it all. And it certainly does seem to be clearly the case that the early Christians expected that they were living at this sort of pivot point in history, and that was central to how they thought about things. And I don't think we can avoid that. I don't think we can explain it away. The question is, what does it mean to be a Christian if they were wrong about stuff? I'm going to be wrong about stuff too. So, maybe it's just okay. Let's all get together and be this religion that accepts people when they're wrong about stuff. Even if we just did that, I think we'd be making some serious progress in getting at the heart of Jesus' message. But there is a serious problem there nonetheless. And happy to, we could go into a lot of detail and spend the rest of our time talking about that if you want to get into the nitty gritty, but I'm not sure how deep you want to go on that.
Well, here, let me jump back to the Matthew bit first, where, you made your point how Matthew's not playing fast and loose, but rather, is doing maybe some typology working. Like one way that I try to think about it is almost like, it's almost like they're like the authors of scripture are like theologizing their history.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're writing, they're not like doing video camera footage, right? Like how we think history should be done. But rather they're talking about their history, but also trying to make sense of like their relationship with Yahweh or with the events that are happening, and they're trying to figure out how does this work within our interpretive framework, and then they're like bringing that to the like actual like what they're doing. Does that make sense, like theologizing history? I don't know if that phrase works or not, but
yes. I mean, so there have been lots of different views about how the scriptural texts relate to history, and both within Judaism and within Christianity, there are huge numbers of people who identify with this tradition, who encounter God through this tradition, and yet who don't think that these texts are at least primarily about history. That doesn't mean that there isn't history to be found in them, right? I mean, as somebody who does work on history, I think these texts are very, very useful. But ultimately, the kinds of things that we would ideally like to write, you know, the kind of documentation we'd ideally want to have if we were doing research on a modern figure, is never available when you're dealing with an ancient figure. And whether it's Jesus, John the Baptist, Paul, anyone else, there are no exceptions to this. Nobody was walking around and recording it all, right? Even in terms of, you know, very quick with the wax tablet, right? Trying to like jot down notes using the ancient technology that was available to them. It just wasn't the way things worked. And so we get memories of this, and it's not all fabrication and stuff that's made up. They clearly cared about remembering, but once you've gotten away from the idea that these texts have been made inerrant, and so the whole issue, all the issues related to human memory on the front end, and then all the issues related to historical investigation and weighing evidence on our end, you know, essentially the doctrine of inerrancy is an attempt to avoid that because people don't want the uncertainty that comes with it. But what, you know, if you believe that God was at work in the process in any way, shape, or form that leads to us having these texts or people encountering God and writing about it or whatever you think was the case, we were not given, right? We can look at these texts and say we were not given things that allow us to bypass that uncertainty. And so maybe that's actually why there's this emphasis on faith, right? Understood not as believing without evidence, much less believing in spite of evidence to the contrary or something like that. It's about trusting God precisely because God is the ultimate and we are, as human beings, regularly wrong even when we're trying our hardest, never mind when we close our minds and are dogmatic about stuff. And so the message comes across, and it comes across in what these authors say, but I think it also comes across through the presentation, right? Through the fact that they are, as you put it, theologizing history, that it's that message, it's that encounter with God that we're supposed to take away from this. It's not that we're supposed to say, okay, here I have inerrant truth that allows me to be certain so that I can believe that I'm right all the time and therefore I can win every argument. That whole approach is very popular in certain circles, but I think it is fundamentally at odds with some of the teaching of these supposedly inerrant texts, which is kind of ironic when you think about it.
Right. Yeah. A part of also a way that's been helpful to think about that for me is like, if I look at the biblical authors, instead of, you know, I grew up being taught that the Bible speaks with one voice, that it's univocal. But when I recognize like, okay, well, I don't think that's true. The Bible is multivocal text. And it looks like there is, like internal debates or disagreements going on. And, you know, the people who canonized the thing, they weren't idiots. They knew it was there and they still chose to canonize it. Then maybe what if my approach to reading the Bible isn't, you know, what you were just saying, the like, now I have, you know, objective truth, da da da, but rather an invitation into a larger conversation that's been going on. And now it's like, okay, like Josh, here's the conversation that's happening. Now, like James and Josh get to sit down and are a part of the conversation as well. And, you know, does that, yeah, that's been a helpful way for me.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's what I say, you know, it's very convenient, maybe intentionally, somebody putting together this collection of scriptures thought this would be useful. Right at the beginning, we have these two different accounts of creation. And maybe, you know, while some have said, you know, what you're supposed to do is take chapter one and then chapters two and three and really work hard to not see any discrepancies between them. But there, you know, that's a good example of the fact that you're interpreting, right? Somebody has primed you to approach this text. And when you see those differences, to try to harmonize them, right? There isn't a preface before the start of Genesis 1 that tells you to do that in writing, but in your mind and in your faith tradition, there may be, right? And so that's, you know, the interpretive framework that you've been given before you encounter the text. It would be very easy to read these texts and say things like, okay, maybe these two different accounts are here right at the beginning, and they are a guide to how I should approach this collection, that it's okay to have these two different accounts where the order is different, and it's okay to have these different perspectives, because it's not about giving me all the details of how these things happened. It's about exploring sort of the idea of God as creator in different ways. And maybe, just maybe, if there's a talking animal in there, some of what I've learned about what genre has talking animals in it is relevant to how I think about these stories. And if that seems like, oh, no, that's not how you're supposed to take it, just in the Bible, right? All those other stories I've talked about, those are, you know, they're fables and they're symbolic and other things. But this one, it's the text doesn't say that. That's the interpretive framework that you've been given, and you're imposing it on these texts. It's entirely possible that the reason why there isn't a preface telling you to do those things is because you're supposed to use the things you know about literature and talking animals and things like that to understand what you're dealing with here and make sense of it.
Yeah, it's like when I used to still teach students, one way of making that point about, you know, the importance of genre and such was like, hey, if I handed you like the Cat in the Hat and asked you to read it, like, you're not going to come back to me and report it to me as like, give me like, you know, this is a real thing that actually happened, you know, verbatim kind of thing. But you could still talk to me about it in a way that's meaningful with important lesson, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, a cat with, you know, that can balance on a ball with like a fish and a thing, and they can both talk, is giving some clues about how we should or shouldn't engage with the text.
Yeah. And even ones that are, you know, kind of realistic, right? Somebody gets robbed on the road to Jericho, right? And so, you know, if you approach this story about, you know, the priest, Levite, and the Samaritan, and are like, yeah, well, we can prove that this actually happened, and we can figure out what the man's name was, and we can get to figure out the exact, it's like, I think you may have missed the point of right. why Jesus told this story and what you're supposed to be paying attention to, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there is a lot of, I forget who kind of coined this phrase, but a lot of adventures in missing the point. Mm-hmm. When we try to read the Bible in a way that's not how it's asking to be read, I guess. But all right, so I personally, I am pretty interested in a lot of like the kind of historical Jesus type stuff, mm-hmm. which you mentioned earlier. And so I'm looking at time. I have like three questions that are not small questions that I want to ask about Jesus and see and see what we can do. What do you think? We'll try. All right, so when it comes to like, all right, let me step back. I used to be in this thing called Jesus Collective when I was a pastor, which was really cool because essentially it was giving me a framework where they said, okay, Jesus is the center of all that we do. This is our hermeneutical key, you know, the lens in which we read scripture, do theology, etc. And I was like, great, that's really cool. What Jesus are we talking about? They're like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, are we talking about like Mark Driscoll's like UFC fighter, like, I'm going to kick your ass, Jesus? Or are we talking about like Thor, right? The like blonde hair, blue eyes, kind of wrapped in an American flag with an AR-15, Jesus? Or are we talking about like a brown dude? Like, what's happening here? And so to me, like, that kind of drummed up in me, like, well, like, how do I actually know that what's in the Bible is what Jesus actually said? And so that kind of like pulled a rug out from underneath that whole like Jesus-centered thing for me, and it was difficult. So what advice do you, maybe you have, or like how would you think about that for someone who like me, it's like, well, can we even trust the words of Jesus in the Bible?
Right. Yeah. So I think there are two things I would say. And obviously we could come, you know, if you want to have a, if you're like, okay, we should dig into this more, we could have a follow-up conversation another time where it's like, okay, here are the long answers, right, to the year three questions. But in short, on the one hand, it only takes the biblical Jesus, right, as depicted in any or all, any of the four gospels or all of them smushed together to avoid the AK-47 carrying flag wrapped Jesus, right? You're not, that's not the Jesus you encounter in the Bible, right? Even putting aside the historical question. If you do historical research, then the question of how, the question is just how does the actual figure who lived in history relate to these stories? And so it's a bit like, if you have three different biographies of any famous person, Martin Luther King Jr., Mohandas Gandhi, Alexander the Great, if you want to go back in ancient history or something like that. And you say, okay, they're similar and yet they're different. And how do I, and where do I think this person got this information from? They have a source for it. It's a really compelling story. Maybe they're just telling it because it was a compelling story. Maybe they made it up because it's a compelling story. Maybe they believed it, whoever told it to them, because it was a compelling story. Do I have a way of fact-checking this? And it's not as though historians, I mean, there certainly are historians who take the approach that, I'm going to doubt everything unless I can prove it to a very, very high degree of confidence. And that is one approach. But with ancient history, there are limits to that, right? You're going to end up with a very minimalistic portrait. And that's because you're being as skeptical as possible. And what's important there is that even if you take that approach, historians who take that approach consistently still detect the outline of a historical Jesus and certain characteristics about him, right? And that's a good thing. It's a positive thing. You can be very skeptical and you still have some hint of this figure coming through. But you brought up your waiting for the possibility of serving on jury duty. And so I often make reference to what happens in a court of law, because trying to prove anything about the ancient world beyond reasonable doubt is too high a standard, right? And so I tell people, if you're doing a civil case, the standard is more probable than not. And we can say a lot about Jesus that it's more probable than not, right? We get the bare outline, right, from Nazareth, certain kinds of teaching referred to God as Father in Aramaic, using the word Abba, which doesn't mean daddy, it just means father, but speaking in his sort of own vernacular, and addressing God in that way. There were people who believed he was the Messiah. Some of the things that he said seemed to suggest that he thought so as well. And he's executed, and there are things like that. But then there's a lot more where we can say either probably, or at the very least, we don't have actually, if we want to say we're not going to accept anything unless we have, multiple strands of evidence and this, that, and the other, fine. But there are plenty of things where it's like there's no particularly good reason to think Jesus didn't say this either, right? Now, there's some stuff where it can be very disconcerting. I did my doctoral work on the Gospel of John, and that one is particularly tough because every character in that gospel kind of speaks in the same way, right? John the Baptist, Jesus, the narrator, right? And the author of the Johannine epistle, right? They all sound like they're talking in the same kind of way, right? There's the of this world, not of this world, above and below, light and darkness, all this kind of stuff. But the truth is that if you spent time studying with someone, on the one hand, you might be very influenced by them. And then on the other hand, the way you're going to remember them is going to be shaped by Josh, right? And my memory of, I studied with James Dunn, and my memory of him is, my memory of him. Other people will remember things and say, oh, I remember this, it's going to be something different. And even the phrases, there are probably things that he said that have influenced me and I've made my own. There are others where I may have interpreted what he said in light of the way I think about things. And that's really all we have, right? And there's no way of avoiding that human subjectivity. And the good news is that the Bible would lead us to believe that we don't have to escape our own subjectivity, right? That people had encounters with Jesus, and they encountered Jesus not with like the Nicene and Chalcedonian creeds attached to him and floating overhead, but as a human being, right? And they had this encounter and perceived something of God at work in him. And it didn't come with a lot of metaphysical baggage, didn't come with a lot of dogma. It was experience, and people's experience changed their lives. And so I think that there too, even the limits of what history can show can help us from trying to turn faith into something that is, follows the rules of history or science, rather than as something that is about an encounter with transcendence, something that, it's much more appropriate to express in poetry, in music, in silence sometimes.
Yeah, that's helpful. Absolutely. And as you were talking, one of the things you mentioned was like the messianic bit. And so I know you did a you have a chapter on that. If I remember correctly, you called it like Greasy Jesus or something like that. which was a pun on like anointed kind of thing. And so my question in that regard is like, yeah, so where do you kind of like where do you kind of come down, or how do you see things around, like basically Jesus's understanding of like, okay, did Jesus think Jesus was the Messiah? Was Jesus like trying to speak into this kind of messianic vocation? And also, this one might be a little bit more difficult and unfair, but what about divinity? Was Jesus going around thinking he was God as well?
Oh, that's not unfair. I've talked quite a bit about that subject. So I started out doing, the reason I started out doing doctoral work on the Gospel of John and its portrait of Jesus, what in technical terms is called Christology, is because coming through an evangelical framework, conservative framework, I was like, okay, four gospels, all in the New Testament, they should basically all be on the same page about Jesus. And then I took a course, first course at Bible college, first academic course on the Gospel of John. And I'm like, no, this one really is different. And making sense of that was, kind of important to me. Even in that gospel, Jesus is still saying, I mean, as he's depicted there, right, through the lens of this author and so on and so forth. Praying that they may know you, right, addressing the Father, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent, right? And so, even in that gospel, Jesus is not walking around thinking, I'm the second person of the Trinity, what should I do today, right, kind of thing. It's a man who told you what he heard from God. It is, if he's the Word made flesh, it's because the one God, right, of Judaism has, these aspects, the word, wisdom, spirit that can be personified, and you're encountering this like as a lived presence in the life of Jesus, but it's not as though Jesus is, merged with a pre-existing person in that way. Although in the Gospel of John, we do start to get, some messianic ideas of pre-existence, and you get the wisdom and logos Christology and all this stuff blurring together in ways that I don't think the author had actually managed to work out completely. Because, like, how does this messianic, pre-existent Son of Man thing relate to the pre-existence of the Word? And then the Spirit comes at the baptism. Is that the moment when the Word becomes flesh, or is the Spirit and the Word different thing? And it's, it all gets, I don't think the author had worked all this out or was trying to. But in terms of messianic understanding, I do think, there are some sayings that it's hard to make any sense of unless Jesus understood himself in those terms, right? There are things like, in the new creation, you will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, right? And that's often thought to be an authentic saying because one of the gospel authors changes it to thrones rather than 12 thrones, because if it's 12 thrones, then Judas is included. And doesn't Jesus know that Judas, you shouldn't be giving him a throne then, it's like, you're gonna do. So it's, if that's authentic, then Jesus thinks his followers are going to have this exalted role in the coming kingdom. And it's very unlikely that he doesn't think that he, and probably also his mentor John, have an even more exalted status in that kingdom that's coming. What I think happened, and this was central to my research, particularly this past year, is that Jesus, when he steps into this role of taking up the reins of John's movement after John is imprisoned, and starts thinking that maybe he is the one that John was talking about who will come, that whatever it means to be the stronger one, he's actually going to follow a path that's much more like John's path, right? John's death, I think, had caught John's movement off guard, right? I mean, they thought that, well, it's the end, right? The end is here and God's going to bring judgment, so God will defend, and we may have to suffer before it comes, but he's not going to let his chosen one be killed. And I think Jesus saw himself as destined to be a Messiah who will be exalted by God, but is not to make that try and make that happen through any force of arms. Figure after figure throughout the scriptures, when they tried to exalt themselves, God was like, "Yeah, you're not ready yet," and sends them into the wilderness, something else. And Jesus was like, "There's no fort. It's God is going to do this." And I think that's why, rather than disappearing when he's killed, it actually becomes this vibrant movement, right? That basically takes over the world, because he was the kind of figure where, even though he didn't say it all ahead of time so that everyone could just have it all worked out in advance, but he was the kind of figure where you could say, no, we can make sense of this, right? We can make sense of a crucified Messiah, the most puzzling of all things imaginable, a crucified Messiah. In light of this person that we spend so much time getting to know, this makes sense. And so I think, even though there's a lot of rethinking that has to happen after the crucifixion, I think that there, even that reworking gives us some important clues about what Jesus actually was like.
Yeah, that's again helpful. Thank you. And I guess like a quick follow-up on that Messiah bit. It's my understanding, and again, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there was other like during Jesus's time, it's not like he was the first dude to roll up and like start trying, tying into that messianic like vocation or vision. There were like other like would-be messiahs, right? Like this was kind of a thing, or no?
So most of the figures that John and Jesus, most often Jesus, because he's gotten a lot more attention, but John and Jesus get compared with, are figures that come along slightly later. And so you've given me a wonderful opportunity to talk about these books that are coming out later this year, about John the
All
Baptist.
right. Well, it
But
must have been the Holy Spirit, James.
there you go.
The divine lure. I was attentive.
Thank you for paying attention and being open to, but yeah, it's there are these figures that they try to enact signs based on, scriptural paradigms, much like, Jesus said, destroy this temple, I will destroy this, or I will destroy this temple and rebuild it in 3 days. And then there's a lot of damage control related to that. But these other figures actually gather people and say, no, it's gonna happen, it's gonna happen now, just follow me. And then the Romans intervene in a way that they didn't in the case of John and Jesus. They get rid of just the ringleader because they're clearly not that kind of troublemaker. But I think all of these figures probably stem from the impact of John the Baptist, right? Historians have said they're comparable, but have been surprisingly willing to say, well, it must be the spirit of the age, and everybody was getting on board. It's like, when you have figures that are all following this pattern, we should look for, who's the person that said, somebody's going to come and they're going to follow this pattern. And I think John basically set the stage for that, which means that we see the impact of John the Baptist, not just in Jesus and Christianity and everything that follows from there, but in the events leading up to the Jewish War and in other areas as well. And so I think John the Baptist was a much more significant figure than people tended to notice, because they have rushed past him on their way to Jesus a lot of the time and not stopped to look, even though Jesus actually says that John the Baptist was, well, of those born of women, which means human beings, there's none greater than John, so Jesus thought highly of him.
Yeah, and Jesus was like baptized by the dude, which is probably something that has actually happened, right? Because it'd be like embarrassing to have like your guy baptized by the other guy. So it's like, oh, that probably happened.
And there's increasing discomfort. I mean, I don't know. I think as Christianity, even before it's known as Christianity, Jesus is initially, the question is he John's successor, right? And it's once, and while it's still in that phase, I don't think that Jesus being baptized by John was embarrassing. But I think as it starts to get to wanting to say, John is simply the forerunner, and Jesus is where all your attention should go. And, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain who actually got some, was pulling some of the levers at the start of this whole thing. That's when it starts to become embarrassing. Yeah. So there's this criterion of embarrassment, which I think sometimes gets misunderstood. And some people actually have tried to say we can't even really use it anymore. But it's a basic principle of historical reasoning, which is if you get the sense that a certain author is embarrassed by something, then they didn't make it up. And it was probably widely known, and so it couldn't just be easily swept under the rug.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you. I'm excited now even more so for those John the Baptist books. I knew that they were in motion, so that's exciting. Well, how about this? How about we... I have so much stuff on my list. Let's let's wrap up with, if we're going to stick with the Jesus theme, let's talk a little bit about the resurrection, because there's some weird stuff that happens, right? Like maybe there's zombies in the New Testament or something like that coming out of the grave. I don't know. Did like the people who came back from the dead, you know, like Jesus raised them from the dead, they aren't there. Do they have to die again? Are they resurrected? You know, these kind of things.
Yeah, and only Matthew tells that story. Matthew sometimes adds stuff, and that's
come on,
one
Matthew.
That's one where, you know, even, you know, those who are kind of inclined to, it's like, I want to give benefit of the doubt where possible. It's still like, okay, I don't know what Matthew is up to here, but there's something, you know. I mean, just imagine this, right? Like, just imagine this. So somebody's an ancient person from Israel's history, and they are brought back to life, right? And it says, they were brought back to life, and after the resurrection, they appear. So apparently they are hanging around somewhere waiting for the resurrection, you know, because it's like, well, we still want to give, you know, we don't want to distract from Jesus' resurrection, so we better hang out until, you know, he gives us the go-ahead or something, right? But then you walk around, and what do? It's like, hi, I'm Elijah. It's like, hi, you know, that's my name too. You know, great to be named after the prophet. No. I mean, I am like, yeah, it's like, what year is this? Yeah, what's happened since I died? It's like, why don't you believe me that I'm who I say I am? I mean, why would God raise these people and put them through that, right? And then where do they go after that? Are they still hanging around? Do they never die again? Is this the final resurrection? Or do they have to have this weird experience of nobody believing they are who they say they are, and then they eventually, you know, starve to death because everybody thinks they're crazy, and then they die again? And it's like, what's the point of this scene, right? And so I think treating it as... seems most likely that it's basically a way of trying to symbolize Jesus's resurrection's connection with the resurrection of the dead in general. Then we can get it, right? Whereas if you ask the question, okay, in practice, what's going on here? How does the rest of the story unfold? You realize, yeah, that's not going to work very well. Yeah, it's been fun teaching a course on the Bible and music. Yeah, and so, you know, it was point out that we get some singing very early on. And women, you know, Miriam was a sister leading singing, you know, probably story being transmitted through song there. But what people don't stop to think about is, okay, the Exodus, basically it's like the musical episode, right? It says that they stop right after the Exodus and they sing the song. Okay, so first you've got to write this song, right? So they have a little songwriting camp there, right? And then you got to teach everybody the song if they're all going to sing it together, right? And no cinematic depiction will ever depict this like songwriting session and musical. It doesn't make any sense, right? When you start to take it literally, right? It's the musical episode where everybody just breaks into song and you're supposed to suspend your disbelief and just accept everybody's singing because it's a crucial emotional moment in the story. And that's what this is, right? And so once again, I think that allowing our common sense to guide our interpretation, it's not contrary to being a person of faith. It's not being unwilling to believe. It's you're supposed to ask these questions, right? The story raises these questions. If you're not asking, okay, what do famous ancient people raised from the dead do during this story and after the story is ended and this gospel over? Where are they? What are they getting up to? How is this supposed to work? You know, if you're not asking those questions and saying, maybe this is a symbolic rather than literal detail, then I think you're actually not taking these texts and what they say as seriously as they deserve to be, right? You're avoiding taking the detail seriously and trying to shoo that away because it's somehow supposedly inappropriate to ask these questions. The text is raising the questions. Dive in, and accept that some of it's pointing to a the possibility that some of this is not meant to be taken literally.
Sweet, right on. All right, well, James, I guess so. I know I said that was my last question. Do you have a few more minutes?
I have a few
Like
more minutes, but do you want to just do you
what?
want yeah, I mean, do you want to just say, okay, let's do a part two sometime? I mean, I'm
Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely. I'm always down for part two.
Yeah, but we can
Especially
do
I'm
both.
ex Okay,
Yeah,
cool.
so
Well, yeah, I'll ask you the one more question then, but I'm down for a part two, especially with the John the Baptist stuff. That's deeply intriguing to me. I'm very curious about that. So my final question would just be this. Since I mean, again, you have 26 different chapters covering 26 different ideas, and you've done a couple of these conversations thus far. Is there one of the things that you're like, I can't believe I haven't got to talk about this yet? I really enjoy this chapter or something like that. Is there one that I don't know, anything that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, most of the major ones have come up. And probably right after we end this conversation, I'll be like, oh, I know what I should have mentioned. But, there is one, about, sort of puns and Jesus' sense of humor. And I definitely drew the conclusion after, spending a full year thinking about almost nothing else except John the Baptist, that John had a sense of humor too. I mean, he had a sharp wit. I think he was quite a charismatic personality. In just the few words that we have attributed to him in the New Testament, I mean, there are puns and there's imagery, all this vibrant imagery and stuff like that. And so I think it's no mystery why John and Jesus got along so well, and Jesus, felt drawn to this figure, because we see some of those same things in the teaching of Jesus. And he particularly seems to have liked puns about camels, right? I mean, he talks about a camel going through the eye of a needle, and that's not a gate in Jerusalem, right? That's just a story rich people tell one another to try to make themselves feel better. He, talked about straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel, and there's a wordplay in Aramaic there. But and he has all this picturesque imagery, which, if you act it out, I mean, it's comical, right? I mean, you think about, there's a famous thing about, seeing the speck in someone else's eye and not noticing the beam in your own. And I keep thinking that, I don't think the disciples, Jesus got the disciples to act it out, but you're supposed to envisage it, right? And your mental image is supposed to be essentially a Three Stooges skit, right? Where one of them is like, I got something in my eye. And then the other one's like, let me help you, right? And the other one's ducking because the beam is swinging as he's saying, oh, wait, I can help you, right? And he's useless and he doesn't see what's in his own eye and that this is, a bigger problem that he should be focusing on. And Jesus used this vibrant comical imagery, and I think John the Baptist did too, in order to, get things across. And so there too, I think we see the richness of these stories and how, unless we know, okay, why would somebody strain out a gnat, right? And then what's the comparison with a camel and all this? Unless you dig into what the background is to some of this, and I won't do this. I'll just leave it as tantalizing to the the listeners to read the book or look at the footnotes in their study Bible. They probably have one of those, But there's more to the text than a quick surface level reading in English without asking about cultural context, about stuff like that. There's things you'll miss. And asking what more is there here and reading things about the text that might help you understand that and give you some of that background information is, again, something that you can do at any level, right? And I've tried to make it really easy to get into it in this book and do it in a sort of a popular way and hopefully a fun way, easily readable way. But you can dig in at any level you want to go to, right? And so the Gospel of John has been compared to like a magical pool in which, children can just get wet up to their ankles and yet an elephant can dive in and swim. And I think the whole Bible is like that, right? Where you can just go into ankle level and get, some basics from it. And if that's all you're interested in doing, you're great. You get what you can at that level. But there's depths to it. And if you're inclined to explore, then I hope that my books will help you get in a little bit deeper, and see what else is in there.
Well, James, I think at least for myself, experientially, you accomplished that. It is, I have had a very weird relationship with the Bible ever since I stopped being a pastor. And so I don't do a lot of Bible type conversations directly on this podcast much. And I really enjoyed your book. I found it engaging. I think I've said this on here before, but I feel bad saying it, but I feel like I enjoy reading about the Bible more than I do actually reading it. And I don't know if that's bad to say. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But I think perhaps if I were to go back and actually, with some of the knowledge and things that I've gained like through your book and conversations like these, going back and reading the Bible again, like almost fresh or new, would probably actually be a really enjoyable experience. So you've at least got my interest piqued as someone who's cynical and, you know, these kind of things. So thank you.
Happy to. That's what I'm all about. And so yes. I'm glad.
All right, man. Well, again, thank you. And we'll definitely do a part two. I'm keeping my eye out for those John the Baptist books. And yeah, I'll be sure to link your stuff in the show notes so people can find you. You know, links to your book, to like your teacher profile, you know, whatever you think is best. And we'll go from there.
Sounds good. Yeah. Fantastic. Great
good
talking
deal.
With you.
Yes. Great to talk to you. And listeners, as always, thanks for hanging out. And we'll see you next time. Peace and love, guys.